We've hit the witching hour, so good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our Audit and Accounts Committee. The minutes of 23rd of February are circulated and published. Has anyone got any comments on them? Or are we accepting
off,
them?
Mr. Chairman.
Apologies.
Councillor Aspin substituted by Councillor James and Councillor Loughran substituted by Councillor Hobbs.
Thank you. Have we anybody who's not here who hasn't apologised?
Councillor Leeson, I've not heard from either way.
Right, so we're missing Councillor Leeson or his substitute. Fine. Moving on then to item three, officers' reports. I'll rattle along because we've got a few pages to get through here. Maybe I'll switch mine off as well then.
Round of port, Mr. Chairman.
Well, mine's not rung yet.
Two rounds of port, Mr. Chairman.
What's that for arguing? Okay, item number 3A, anti-fraud and bribery, money laundering and speaking up frameworks. These are all updates of reports that we have. We've got copies here showing what's been updated. But I'm going to ask our colleagues to run through them fairly smartly.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'll take members of these. So as the Chair said, these are our three existing policies that we've had. The previous versions were last approved in 2016, so they were probably due an update, and it had been flagged in the BFM report a need to update these. So by bringing these through, we are able to tick off three of the actions in there and help us on that plan. In terms of the content, the probably the biggest one that's changed is the speaking up framework, and that has previously been referred to as confidential reporting, and before that it was a whistleblowing policy. It essentially is in place as a frontline reporting mechanism where we can take concerns and pass them on to other policies and other processes, or if they are very minor, deal with them in their own right. As part of the review, as I said, we have rebranded this to Speaking Up, taking on board the way the NHS and some other sectors have gone to try and make it a more positive document. So rather than it being a way of reporting concerns confidentially, we're trying to create a culture where employees are encouraged to speak up if they see anything wrong. And we feel that puts a bit of a better, more positive message out there than the negative whistleblowing and the connotations that come up with that. More fundamentally, it hasn't changed in terms of it still allows staff to report it. It ticks the box for the Public Interest Disclosure Act requirements for employees. But as previously, we go further and we allow non-employees to use the same routes, and we put the same protections in if it's a member of the public, a contractor, or anybody else who has concerns. They can use this as a reporting mechanism. The anti-fraud and bribery framework again is fundamentally the same. It's a reporting mechanism as well as a prevention and investigation framework for us if we do get any concerns of fraud and bribery. This has been updated to take on board more recent legislation from the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act, and particularly around the failure to prevent fraud offence that is now in effect. That came on board in September last year. and that means that a large organisation can be held liable if employees commit fraud, if they didn't have appropriate arrangements in place to try and prevent and detect fraud. We do come under that. I would say our previous arrangements were thorough enough to be able to give us a reasonable defence if that was levied at us. Certainly with the changes we've got now, again, I think we are protected, but the policy's been updated to reflect that. It's also been updated to reflect the government's fighting fraud locally policy and the pillars that they put in there. So broadly what we do are in line with central government's anti-fraud sort of campaigns for local governments. So we're trying to follow the best practice that we can do in there. And the money laundering framework is what it says on the tin, really. It's a mechanism where if there are any concerns of money laundering to any transactions, we have a mechanism that we can capture it to show what we've done and if necessary report it to the relevant police bodies who could then go on and investigate it. So if we get large cash payments and we don't know where they've come from, probably a topical one with what we've got going on, if there's suddenly a developer comes on board wanting to take part in our major regeneration projects and we're a bit suspect of how are they actually getting their funding, we've got mechanisms there to capture that concern and report it for somebody to review. You've got a copy of the track changes version there. You've had the policies on the agenda to review it, so I'm not going to go through them page by page.
Well, shall we just ask then?
If there are any questions, yeah, Chair, I'm happy to take them.
Shall we take each section on its own? Speaking up framework, has anyone any questions on that one? The anti-fraud and bribery framework? Yeah.
You said, developer could you've got to check the funding. Does that mean any developer puts in a bid to do any work? You've got to do an in-depth study of their finances.
There is an underlying expectation in the money laundering framework and anti-fraud and bribery that we do due diligence on anybody we work with. So if it's somebody we don't know, a new developer, then there would be a general expectation that we would do some checks of are they a legitimate company, are they viable, or are they doing that in the same way as we would for suppliers. Obviously the bigger the scheme, the more money that's involved, potentially the higher the level of the bar we would want to do about how much detail we might want to check. We can do certain checks through Spotlight, which is a central government scheme to make sure firms are legitimate, they've got tax records and things like that, and we use that internally already for some of the grant claims, some of the UK SPF grants that go out. They will check on Spotlight to make sure they are going to legitimate companies and things like that. So we already do some of that at a low level, but obviously the bigger the risk of the project, the bigger the funding, the more certain we've got to be about it is a legitimate company and they're not using it for money laundering or other things.
Just thinking that could be a lot of work, couldn't it? That could slow down like issuing contracts, could it? Is it?
It's an established part of the procurement process, so that could be going on in the background while other things are going on anyway. And some of the procurements we do are through pre framework agreements, so the financial vetting would have already been done by somebody else, so we might do sort of more limited checks on our part of it as that.
Roy?
Can I just be assured that legal has been through this and approved and signed it off?
Yeah, they will have seen the copies, they will have checked it, certainly before it's gone through legal. It goes through the leadership team where the monitoring officer sits, and they check the legislation for us.
Okay, so agenda item 3A.
Questions
on page 29?
Page 6, training.
Page
so
6,
under
training.
Under implications 6.1,
yep.
Says financial implications, and then talks about training has been requested. Yep. I'm just interested in what is the training to cover, who is it for, and what approach are you proposing? Because you talked about, particularly with the speaking up as a kind of cultural thing, obviously changing policies and changing culture, but also like tedious e-learnings don't change culture either.
So, if I may check, yeah, we are looking at a mixture, and we are looking to see what we can do. Yeah, some of the plans to get this awareness out of the fundamentals of this will be through some e-learning. We can do the sheep dip training and get that out. And there are some reasonable packages out there. I have looked at some. And we have used a supplier for a number of courses, which is quite good. So we will do some of that. We will also be circulating this to relevant employees, promoting it. I did have a conversation with Judith about possibly doing something through comms and getting some other messages out there as well, so that we've got an employee newsletter and things like that that we can do. And to try and make it so that it's not just a one-off exercise, that we are doing things a bit more sporadically and reminding people. That's probably one of the things we're guilty of in the past is we've done sporadic training, sporadic awareness when we've updated policies or the anti-fraud we did 2 years ago and we haven't done it for a few years before that. So perhaps getting something a bit more living. There are some other aspects in there that will probably help with that, that I don't know if Judith wants to comment on, but outside of this, we are updating the council's code of conduct, which Judith's done a lot of work on, and we are introducing values, or talking of values for employees as well, to support the code of conduct and that. So there's a lot of other culture work, values work, and sort of ethical framework arrangements in place that this all sits as part of.
And as Stephen said, Chair, that's probably where we'll look to do a little bit more around the cultural side of it, is off the back of that. And that references the speaking up framework as well, so that we've got some connectivity between the two on that. And I think for certain parts of this, we'll be doing some targeted training on certain teams that, you know, that perhaps have got more opportunity of being involved, particularly around the London Audit side of things. It's not something every member of staff is going to come across. But we've got certain teams that we would want to do a little bit more detailed work with them. So.
Yeah, as I say, there will be the sheep dip, but certainly on speaking up and anti-fraud to get everybody through, to get some awareness and to give them the policies as well. And then we will be more targeted and a bit more lively training if we can, and target the people who need it. The money laundering, it's a very small number probably who will be exposed to it.
Just for the speaking up in particular, have you considered engaging trade union reps? Because quite often if someone has that sort of concern, that may well be someone that they directly go and speak to in the first instance.
Well, funnily enough, actually, we've just done a consultation with the trade unions on the code of conduct, and I say it is referenced. So we did touch on it when we briefed them, and I'm just working through some comments on it. I don't think they've specifically picked up on this. I think generally speaking, staff are quite good. If they don't feel comfortable in going to their manager, they don't feel comfortable going to HR, they will find their way to a trade union rep if they're in a trade union.
And this policy does reference that the trade unions are a route that people can use to raise concerns, and we're sort of linking, coming at it both ways from that.
So it's more on training, just to either internally or give them a heads up.
I would say we do operate a very open door policy, and particularly the chief executive. Most staff feel very comfortable in going directly to the chief executive if they're not happy with something. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that takes us to the end of item 3A, unless anyone's got any other comments?
We are to approve these, Mr. Chairman.
Recommends the adoption.
Yeah.
So do I take it that you are happy that I report that we recommend the adoption?
Yes.
Thank you. Item 3B, Internal Audit Progress Report.
Okay, thank you, Chair. This is me again. So this is our periodic progress report of the work of the audit section and updating the committee on what we've done since our last progress report. As members can see, we have one substantial and three partial assurances in this period, and we have overall, if I draw members, sorry, page, it starts on page 64. We have the tables, if I draw members' attention to the table on page 68. So we've got three partial and one substantial in that bottom table, which is the new work that we've done in the quarter. The table above is our year-to-date work. As we're so close to the end of the year, and based on the fact that we have nine partial and only one substantial assurance audits in the year for the work that we've done, I will be flagging to members that it's highly likely that I will be giving a partial or limited assurance in my annual opinion at the end of this year, just based on the fact that the work that we've done is predominantly coming out as partial assurance. I don't think that will come as much of a surprise, but I think it is worth members being aware at this stage. If I take you over the page to the table that sets out the findings from the audits that we've done, we've got the land charges system, which is a project to link in with His Majesty's Land Registry for them to agree the prime land charges body. And we, although this has been delayed, it's been ongoing for quite a long time, and at the time of writing we hadn't got a date for it moving forward. We found that they were without a detailed project plan ready to go live when that date was set. I do believe we do now have a date when we're going to go over. So we're just flagging to members there that our project management arrangements could be improved for that one. Council tax and NNDR, we've given partial assurance to. And again, this is more unusual. Those are normally systems that are substantial assurance when we've looked at them. Issues are similar on both, and they're predominantly around the use of inhibit codes and the frequency of monitoring those inhibit codes. So this is where we would put a code on to stop us following up on recovery for some reason. Now, they are a valid tool and they are used quite often, but we just had concerns that we weren't reviewing the use of those codes as regularly as we would have liked them to. And some of the codes perhaps seem to have been on the accounts for longer than we would have anticipated them normally being on there. There is an associated issue that there was a higher use of reminders for higher use of inhibit codes for reminders, because we have an associated issue where some payments are coming in, and if they haven't quite got the right references, they go into a suspense account. And there's been a bit of a delay in finance and the Revs and Bens team in looking at those that are in the suspense account, identifying them as council tax or more predominantly business rates, and then allocating them to the right code. So we have suspended recovery on some because the customer saying, I've paid, but we haven't got that payment on the account. So where that's a case, it is then flagged up. And because we've got this underlying issue, it's perhaps led to a higher rate of inhibits than we would like to see. Chair.
Roy.
Can you a bit of education, please? Inhibit code?
So the inhibit. So what would normally happen is you would be billed for council tax or business rates, and we would expect you to pay. If you don't pay or you miss a payment, it gets flagged and a reminder goes out, and then it would go through the normal recovery process. If you put an inhibit code on the account, that stops the recovery from progressing to the next stage while we're carrying out investigations. So, for example, with those on the suspense account, we might have sent a reminder out and the customer phones up and says, oh, well, I paid you on this date. So they would put the inhibit code on whilst they went away to Luke and
see if we had to pay.
So it's like suspending recovery.
Right.
It's just like a flag in the system that suppresses the normal course of recovery action for any people until they take that.
Okay.
But obviously, from our viewpoint, if you suspend recovery and you don't take that code off and they haven't paid, we're not getting the money in. So we do need them to be regularly reviewing the accounts that are suspended. And restarting recovery where it's valid.
Chair, if I may, it's probably worth saying at this point, and those members who are on the Resources Scrutiny Committee will know, because there's a separate piece of work going on looking at our recovery processes for council tax and MMDR, that the two are not directly connected, but I think there is an element of the with some of the backlog we've had, and the team that are now in, the extra capacity that Ross put into the team, we'll start to see that moving naturally, and now with the audit report, that then we're aware of it. So I'm not expecting that one to be an issue that we'll come across again.
I think the other thing in the NNDR for members' attention is we did identify one account that had a £10,000 refund of an overpayment on there, and it hadn't gone through all of the right validation checks to make sure that payment was valid. It was valid in the end, but it had been paid before those checks.
I was about to ask you, was it valid?
Yeah.
It was.
It was valid, but we haven't gone through all of the checks that were supposed to before. So, yeah, obviously, we're flagging that for attention. And I will have to apologise to members. I seem to have made a slight mistake there, because housing benefits on the table has got the symbol for partial assurance, but that is the substantial assurance for what we've done, which is why there's no comments on there. And no recommendations. So, I think in updating the table, I've left a previous one on there. Over the page, we've got the list of the audits in progress. I would expect the majority of these to be done by the time we bring you our annual report. There may be some that we haven't quite finished, but I would anticipate that the majority of those in that table will be completed. Then come on to the follow-ups on page 72. We've got three that have remained partial assurance, and one, the homelessness and housing options, that's moved from partial to substantial, which is a good news story. Probably on page 72 is where I'd draw members' attention to predominantly the section 106 arrangements and projects and the pest and dog control. We've followed up now three times and they are both remaining partial. Action is in progress on all of the recommendations for those, but it is a significant time. Bearing in mind, we normally allow around about 6 months between each follow-up. We're now sort of 18 months after those audit reports were issued, and they are still partial assurance. And it's an opportunity to review what you want to do with those, Chair.
We had a discussion prior to the meeting that we are aware there's a major meeting on 106 taking place, and we would look to see the outcome of that before we follow up further. But in the meantime, we'll probably look to ask the head of department to give us an update, rather than requesting them to appear before the committee, because that would be the normal process. You've not actually cleared it, having had a third follow-up. We want to see you in person to tell us why you're not doing it. But as we've got a piece of work going on next week on the section 106 monies, we felt it would be probably better to ask for a written update to be circulated to the committee members. And then if that's not substantial enough, then we'll ask them to appear.
What about the dog and pest control?
That was my next one.
Yeah.
The dog person to answer.
Yeah.
Chair, if I can.
I don't think there is one, is there?
There is, I think, a service to that falls under. What we were suggesting, we were chatting through, the normal course would be to ask the head of service to attend the next committee meeting. I think we're just mindful the next committee meeting won't be till June. That will be the end of year, whilst it's always a big meeting for the committee. So you could still do that, but what we talked about was asking for both of those ones, for the committee to ask, request the head of service to provide you with a written update in the next few weeks so that you can see that. And then depending on the outcome of that, you could still make a decision to ask them to attend in June if you weren't satisfied with the explanation. And that's where kind of picking up as well what's going to happen at the scrutiny meeting next week, you could see the information from both sources, because the committees have got slightly different perspectives on it. This committee's role is all around the controls that are in place. I think some of that might play out into the other meeting, but I say there is a slight difference. So I say we were just suggesting to potentially ask the head of service to provide the appropriate update first, and then in discussion with the chair, if you're not happy, then we can arrange for them to attend the June meeting.
Could we ask for a specific date by which the report is to be here? Because otherwise I know what happens.
Yeah.
So I would suggest within the next 2 weeks, Mr. Chairman.
Could I suggest you might allow a little longer, given that it is Easter in that, and that will take part of me down.
Two and a half weeks.
Would three be appropriate then?
Yes, ma'am. I was just flagging that. I'm anticipating that at least one of them might have some leave during that period.
Leave.
Just application.
As Judith suggested, I think the section 106, if you have an update from the head of service and ask for the scrutiny chair to provide an update, and then you can review the entirety of that, and the head of service, or actually it may be two heads of service for the pest and dog control, because some elements of that are split between regulatory services and operations, so we may need to get
a collective response on that.
Well, I think at the third follow-up, it's probably a good thing to just get some more information from the committee sooner rather than later.
So, could I just ask who's going to request this? Is it you, Judith? Or is it...
It will get recorded in the minutes of the meeting, but between Jackie and I, we'll make sure that the heads of service are aware.
Okay.
If members are happy, I will carry on and mention the other one that's... partial assurance that first follow-up is food safety arrangements, and two out of the seven recommendations have started, five had not at the start. Whilst it is a little bit slow progress after 6 months, this is the first follow-up, so you may wish to allow a little bit more time for them to progress the actions. We are aware that the team has been undergoing quite a few elements of change and have had some staffing issues that may have impacted on some of those areas, such as the procedure notes being documented and some of the other areas. But certainly I would probably be encouraging members the next follow-up to think about whether you might want to do something and ask for an update, certainly if there isn't any further progress and more of the recommendations haven't been at least started by the time we do our next follow-up. Then again, that is something for members to be concerned about, but it is within your gift to decide.
Well, given the amount of work that we've got going on in reorganisation, I think we can perhaps look at giving them a little bit of leeway.
An extra week,
yeah.
And then the final table that starts on page 75 is the provisional work that we haven't started at the point of time. Now, bearing in mind this goes up to the end of February, it's unlikely that a lot of these will be started in that last period, and we will be focusing on the work still to come. I have put comments in the right-hand column about what we're looking to do, and as you can probably see, most of those we are looking to roll forward into the audit plan, which we have next on the agenda, so you should see that moving forward. There are a few areas where we're suggesting that we've reviewed the audit that we'd originally planned, and it may not be appropriate now. It's not really high risk, situations have changed. So there are a couple that we are proposing to take off the list. So there was some work around community and voluntary sector grants, which was low risk areas. We determined that particular to the head of service involved. There was another one, but I just can't spot it at the moment. But yeah, there are the comments there, so hopefully members can see what we're proposing.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask about the major project governance, where it says some information to indicate some areas of concern.
Yeah.
I just wondered, because they were big projects, that could involve a lot of money or a lot of problems.
Through you, Chair. Yeah, it could do. I mean, we did do some high-level review of the regeneration projects that we've got, but what we haven't done is that deep dive. And what we are planning to do, jumping forward to the next item, really is in the next year's plan, is to do a detailed review of the project governance arrangements for that regeneration project.
What worries me, it's almost like we didn't get around to finishing the audit until the project's finished, do you see what I mean? Because it's possibly a fast-moving programme, so the audit might discover what went wrong after it's gone wrong rather than trying to put it right.
And with the bigger projects, we do try and do pieces of work on the line, particularly the regeneration schemes, because they take place over such a long time, we plan to do them at intervals during the project. I think it's probably fair to say that where we have a weakness on this is there is, we don't have any central expertise on project management, and we lack a set of corporate guidelines and a corporate approach to it. So every team is left to determine for themselves how they want to put their project governance in, and that leads to varying degrees of how they choose to do that. Now, some of them use consultants, so consultants will bring with them their own project management techniques, and that's okay. And generally, that they are better. It is something that is highlighted in the value of money audit, and it's something I still have on my list. But at best, we're likely to do is to organise some training to say I don't have a central resource to spend the time drawing up that toolkit.
And if I may, through you, Chair, that's what that piece of work was originally aimed at doing, is looking at what corporate arrangements we put in place, not the projects themselves. The work we've done on the projects is where we're getting the concern that because we haven't got that corporate guidance, people aren't necessarily always following the best practice.
Just thinking, is it not each department then like inventing the wheel themselves? There's no like templates or any kind of thing that
we don't supply any corporately. I don't have a project management expert to be able to do that piece of work. We do need people to come up with their own. There are plenty around, you don't have to look far on the internet really to find them, and most people will understand the basic concepts of what is required. It's just how well they're going to use it and stick to it. Because again, we don't have the capacity for project assistance in. More often than not, you're just looking at any service team that is doing its best with the resources it has. Very few of them have extra support to put in there. We do have some staff that are trained, quite a number of our managers will have been through project management training at some point. We've got some staff that are trained to kind of print standards. Certainly, I know in the head of operations team, the team that run the kind of the play area for refurbishments, at least one of the officers in that team has done print training and they will project manage at that level. But that's not consistent across the council. And I wouldn't recommend prints too for every project. The regen schemes absolutely is the sort of standard that you're looking for.
Would it not be worth getting a corporate consultant to put it together? Is that too expensive?
I'm not looking at a consultant, but I'm looking at outsourcing some training and asking the trainer to bring the centre talks with it. It's not as good as having somebody yourself who can then be here and police it, make sure that it's done. It won't have the desired effect in real life, but it's the best we're going to be able to do in the circumstance. So that is still on my to-do list, and that's something. I've just had a new officer appointed who's kind of leaving on our list.
applications for and have to do that one for. And if I may, Chair, I think the really big projects, we tend to buy in some project support and projects, I mean, which can lead to its own problems, but they do tend to know the project management better. It may not always follow the way that we would expect or want, but if you're using a project manager who's got their own tools and techniques that they're used to using, it can sometimes complicate it by trying to enforce something. So there's pros and cons with all of it, but it's where we're doing projects that are big but not big enough to require a lot of external buy-in of that type of consultant project manager.
We sometimes find as well that where we're doing projects that are funded through government money that they'll have specific asks, particularly around risk registers, that very few will accept our format. You know, they like to use their own, and we try not to double the responsibility to the staff on that. So, again, we are flexible. So.
Roy.
Can I have an assurance that the two audits that were deferred 24-25 will be completed in 26-27?
Through you, Chair, I will try my best to do those. The one is deferred because of some technical issues and prioritising the final accounts, which we are still spending a lot of time and is still a big drain on resources in terms of the bank reconciliation, and that's why we haven't done that. I can give members as much assurance as we can that the finance team are checking some elements of that, but we haven't been able to do the full element of it.
So that's a yes then.
I will endeavour to do the one. The planning enforcement again has been down to a lack of staff in the team that we're looking at, and we have tried to start that fairly recently, and we have agreed to put it off. So that would have been one that we would have ideally started before the end of this year, but we are on track to try and get it in place.
There's items on here that if they go wrong could seriously damage this council. It is a major concern, and we really ought to be thinking of it as sort of risk register items. If they're not in place, we are putting ourselves at very serious risk.
Jeff, I can assure you that some of the ones I believe you're probably alluding to are on the council's risk register. So,
right.
So, and are either, you know, looked at regularly by the Section 151 officer who we represented on most of those meetings,
yeah.
And by what you're doing now.
I mean, we
might have to ask the Section 151 officer to come to the next meeting to explain where his controls have got us to.
I think we do need to be clear that the controls and the responsibility for them do lie within the service areas.
Yeah.
We obviously will do checks to make sure that they're in place, that they're working as intended, but the ultimate responsibility lies with the head of service and the managers in the area.
Yeah.
We have to support the Section 151 officer in his statutory duties to check that they're in place. It's not his responsibility. But I say we have a duty between us to check that those things are there.
If that point could be made, please. Of the whole body of work we've got here, that's the one area that I feel that we're most at risk on, because they're outside of our normal body of work that we do. You've already mentioned that we don't have major expertise in project management. And these are large sums of money, and we are responsible.
They are, Chair, but it's also an area where we have more consultancy and with expertise to support the team in managing and the delivery of those projects.
We will note your confidence, Judith.
I'm just advising you for the arrangements that you're in place. It's one that, you know, we acknowledge.
That's a yes, then.
It's one we acknowledge that is a concern, and we are continuing to keep an eye on that at different levels.
Yeah.
As I say, Stephen and the audit team are involved, the Section 151 officers are involved as well.
Yeah.
We've got all of our normal channels operating to keep
And I'm sure our cabinet member for finance is making due note of the possible risks in this area.
We do keep our cabinet member that important.
Yeah.
If I may, Chair, to reiterate Judith's point, there's broadly we refer to a three lines model quite often, and the first line is the service responsibility should be reported up how things are doing. We then have a second line, which are functions like project management, overview, health and safety, performance management, finance monitoring, which is the second line, and then we are the independent line as internal audit as the third line, who can give that assurance. So hopefully between the three of us, we focus on the higher risk areas and try and give that assurance, because we can't look at everything. Your second line should be giving some independent assurance in terms of performance and that, but they are internal and within the processes. But the prime responsibility for saying things are going well is the relevant service management structure, and they should be reporting up to cabinet and to Tim as the chief exec in normal reporting.
I will just refer back to your comments about implementation of project management skills. If you ain't got the skills, you're not going to know you're in a mess until it's too late. So you're going to have to watch it. So, have any other comments?
Not on this selection.
So that does that take us on to page 83?
77.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead too far here. My apologies, agenda item 3C.
Okay, thank you, Chair. This is my report again. So this is the internal audit plan for 26-27, and this is the report we always bring through around this time of year, setting out how we're going to assess the work that we want to do, informing members of the resources available and whether we feel that is adequate, and setting out an indicative plan of work. The essence of this is that I have a responsibility at the end of the year to provide an annual conclusion on the effectiveness of the council's governance, risk management, and control arrangements. So the audit plan primarily is setting out the work that I believe I need to do to provide the authority with that conclusion, and also looking at the resources that I have and the skills that I have to say whether we are able to do that. There is a table at the end of it which is setting out the provisional areas that we want to do. But I will be asking members to approve the planning methodology, because what we have for the last few years is not a fixed list of audits that we can do, but it is a methodology that allows us to focus on the higher risk areas and to review that regularly, at least quarterly, and get it updated with agreement from Judith and Chris as Section 151 officer, that we are looking at what we think are the higher risk areas, so that if something changes, we don't have to keep coming back and updating a fixed list. As members will recall from the progress report in the year, I will bring that indicative list through to in every progress report and update you with any changes, any additions, anything that we feel we need to take off in the year. So it isn't we'll bring this once and change it as often as we want without telling you. We will keep you informed as we go. I think the biggest concern that we have, and we always seem to have, is the resources in the team to carry out the work. We are a small section, and we've been carrying a vacancy for a while. We did get fully staffed about 12 months ago, just over 12 months ago now. And unfortunately, one of those didn't work out, and we haven't been able to refill the post. That was after several attempts at trying to find suitable candidates. So we've been carrying that vacancy for a while. The resource estimate in here is slightly less than last year anyway as well, and it was done on a conservative basis because I couldn't say anything in here, but I anticipated what has happened since, and I have had a member of the team put their notice in to retire in May, so I am going to be losing a long-standing member of the team quite early in the new financial year as well. So I am going to be tight on resources to carry out the work. To compensate for that, we have a contractor who we primarily use for IT audit, but they do general audit work. They're one of the medium accountancy firms out there who we've had a long-standing relationship with. They've currently been in to do some general audit work for us this year, and I've already had conversations with them, and they are going to be providing us with additional resource in the new year to help backfill some of the gaps. Where possible, we will also be looking to do some recruitment exercises to minimise that resource hit. But the overlying message on resources is, we are going to be down on resource in the year, and we will try and manage that the best that we can. However, I do still feel that the plan that I'm putting forward and the work that we will be doing will be sufficient for me to be able to give you that opinion at the end of the year for 26-27.
Not a partial one then.
I can't guarantee what that conclusion will be, but I do think I will have enough spread of work across enough areas, and certainly across our higher risk areas that are most concerned, to be able to give that conclusion.
Good. You will have done very well if you do achieve that. And I wish you every luck and
success. So I've got this down as 30 audits you're planning to do.
Yes.
But you're going to be short of staff. And the one I keep bringing up every year, I suppose, for the last 20,000 million years is IT. And I notice we've got 12 weeks, 60 man days.
Yeah.
Are we actually going to get this sorted?
The IT audit work we buy in 60 days a year, and we've done that for the last 13 plus years across two councils, and we've always had that work completed every year. So the IT audit is we buy in and we get the buy-in days every year, so that isn't affected by the loss of staff. We don't have the technical skills in-house to do those technical IT audits, and we wouldn't be able to afford probably to have a specialist IT auditor in ourselves. We look at the likes of our neighbours across the road, they've got one IT auditor in-house for the county council. So they have a larger team, they can afford to buy it, but they can only afford one.
Okay. Just,
any other questions? So, do the committee consider the report and approves the internal audit plan?
Yeah.
Thank you. Takes us then on to page 87, agenda item 3D, update of the strategic risk register.
I'll take this one just to the left. In terms of the table that's on the first page of that, you'll see there's been no change to the number of risks that the council's facing or the scores for those risks either. If we turn to the summary that's on page 91, that's one that illustrates there's been no change in the scores on that. Following that, you've then got an update on all the actions and the work that has taken place over the last quarter for all of the red risks. You don't get the information in year on the annual risk, they're monitored by leadership, so you have got an update in there on what we can do on year one. Work is ongoing, it's just that some of those are going to take a long time to turn around, and some of them we are struggling with at the moment. I think trees is a good example. We said right from the beginning that it's going to take some time to address that risk, and that has been hampered by the staffing difficulties within that team. So we know that one's going to take more time. The corporate capacity one, as we've already flagged to the committee previously, that is one that we know that we're not going to improve the score on that. All we're looking to do on that is maintain it at the position it's at and just try not to let it get any worse.
trickier as time moves on and we progress into local government reorganisation. There's nothing else I particularly wanted to say on any of the individuals, but in terms of that question,
with the corporate capacity, some demands must be just transferring, isn't there?
To the account, yeah. All staff will transfer, the vast majority of staff will transfer to the new council. There will be a smaller number at the top end. Certainly, the chief executive always uses the example, we will not need 10 chief executives, there will be some chief executives that will not make it to the organisation, or certainly not the chief executives, for our leadership team. Some change there, but for the vast majority of our staff, they will transfer, and it will only be some years down the line where things start to take, to change. But in reality, because we have got so many shortages in a number of our professional areas, I don't see us losing staff. I think it's just a case of holding on to what we've got in terms of local government reorganisation. But where we will struggle is there will be people who will just be nervous of that change, and if they see another opportunity, they might transfer to one of the nets that aren't going through this because they're already kind of in a single where we've got vacancy, it's more difficult to recruit because people don't want to come into an organisation that's going through change. We're not seeing too much of that yet. We are still able to recruit in certain places, and I think some people are still seeing this as an opportunity to get that step up, but I say it varies from profession to profession.
Yeah, so it's not as if it's not like a company that's going to shut down and
No.
So I wonder why so many people
I think it's just human nature. But I think at the moment I don't think we've really got anybody leaving because of LGR. I think people are just naturally seeing opportunities and taking them where they would naturally anyway for their personal and professional development.
Do you get to reassure the staff?
Yes, we do. The chief executive does regular briefings, and it is the one area that we always cover, and we always include the fact that the staff, the vast majority of staff,
his job still needs to be done.
Yes, they do. They're our frontline ones. They'll act as we expect to see. We're not expecting to see any impact from those for any number of years. But the reality is, as well, we have shortages nationally in certain key professions.
So the reason you're not recruiting isn't because of the change?
A lot of the time it's because they don't exist. The staff don't exist, or where they do, there are authorities that pay more, and they are going to go to the ones that pay more than we do. Particularly in certain professions, obviously finance, when you've got the county council across the road, they pay more than we do.
They do pay more.
Two jobs
so up. How will that work with your staff transferring?
That will come out in the wash over time as and when we move to an aligned pay scale. But if I could point out that Bournemouth, Christchurch, and Poole would take 5 years, I think it is, to get to their
line.
Yeah, to get
Brighton,
to them.
Brighton haven't yet, and they did it in 1997.
Yeah. So, we've been sharing since 2011. We still have staff on different terms and conditions across the two councils in the shared services. So, there's nothing that compels you. And actually, it is a cost factor. Will that be an element of that? And the conventions generally is online or
transfer of undertakings protection according to regulations.
Recommendations to
the I've been a trade union rep for a transfer before. Quite a big transfer. No. From South East Essex College to South Essex College, which was a huge merger of two FE colleges.
And what in essence it means is when the staff transfer, they transfer on their existing terms and conditions, that's
too low thing.
GP,
that's it.
Yes.
So, a body of work that's going to be ongoing for some time, Judith.
Yes.
We're asked to consider the progress made, and they have the responsibility of monitoring, we do, the risk register. Are we happy that we are monitoring it fully?
Happy, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
That takes us on to item E on page 106.
So that will give us that opportunity to say, actually, yes, it is a recommendation, but you know, we're going to focus on the ones that are more important for us. I'm expecting them actually to put the new recommendations in as well, but not of anything of any significance. So I say I want to take it in the round, have a discussion with the Section 151 officer, and then come to the committee with a revised plan to say, these are the ones that we think we've got capacity to do, the ones that we think are important, and these are the ones that we aren't going to concern ourselves with.
Yeah, we note that there are 23 that are 3 months or more behind, and we fully understand why, but it's not a good number.
No, I think that it is easy to lose sight because I've taken off all of the actions we've already delivered against the original value.
Yeah,
I think that's where perhaps I've lost sight a little bit, and I am. Overall, we have, I think, made considerable progress against it. As I say, it's just I'm now judging us on what's left, and that's where the slippage is starting to come. The big thing we did quite early, you know, we had a very ambitious plan, and I think arguably possibly too ambitious. I think our new external auditors recognise that.
What percentage of that have you managed?
I don't know. What I will try and
that
do.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, I'll have a look. When I do the year end report, I can take the figures from what we'd already done, and if I add all that in, I can give you a sense then of the overall achievement against the original.
It's probably looking better.
Yes, yeah.
So, do I have a recommendation that we note the progress?
Can I just ask though, some of these revised timescales, you've said quarter one, 25, 26, do you mean 26, 27? Well, if you look at page 114.
I suspect that what you're asking me is actually the right one, because it's in that first column and it was the revised timescale, that was where I revised it to from the original one, and we've not delivered it in here. That column in the middle, and it says revised timescale. That's where I revised it to from the very first value for money improvement plan, and we've not achieved the revised one.
There are a lot of red crosses on there, which is not a good view, but we are short of people, and we have been asked to do a full-scale organisational change.
Yeah, and I would like to think as well that the ones that we have done before it's taken off are the ones that were more important to us, because we can front-load for the things that needed to be done.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that there aren't some ones in there that are still important, but we had to take a view and spread them because there were so many in the first place.
We sympathise, but we note what has been progressed and what hasn't. Any other comments, ladies and gentlemen?
What work does the local government organisation involve? I mean, being as it's not been decided yet, where's it going? What sort of work are you happy to do?
Right. So, at the point we were doing this, all the work was centred around putting the proposal in of which model we wanted to operate in Staffordshire. So that was the work that affected that. The work that we're just starting to do now is some early preparatory work. The Ministry for Homes, Communities and Local Government have issued us with a checklist. So while we're waiting for their decision, they're saying, here's a piece of work you can be getting on with. And a lot of that is about starting to collate the data across the different councils. So we're just setting up a project management office across Staffordshire. So it's got all of the councils involved in it with seven different work streams that is literally after Easter, we're starting to meet to start to collect all of that data. So we'll be looking at contracts and comparing what contracts each council has, start looking at the IT systems we've got, what contracts they've got with them. We will be looking at the different T's and C's of our workforce, that sort of thing. So we're just starting to do all that preparatory data gathering and have a general discussion about what things are top of our list, what do we need to have in place from day one of the new authority so that we can start to work off a plan of what do we need to do to get to that point, and that is going to be huge.
Does that include Stoke-on-Trent or not?
Yes.
It does?
Yes, we've got the county, we've got Stoke, and we've got all of the eight districts and boroughs involved at the moment. We've set it up Staffordshire Y because obviously we don't know the outcome
yet. It's
going
to be, yeah.
And so we've got a model that we've put in place, and we're going to stick with that until we know the decision, and we're going to then review whether there's still any merit in keeping a county-wide approach. I think what inevitably we will have is we'll have individual ones for the new councils. It's whether we keep something overarching across the top, and there may be a compelling argument for that. When you're looking at things like disaggregating social care, the county is going to be splitting it. Whichever model we go for, it's going to have to do some level of splitting, so it might be helpful for the current arrangement where we see certain aspects, and then I can see specific PMOs, as they call them, set up for each of the new councils. But interesting, I don't know if any members have seen today, the news is starting to break on the announcements for some of the councils that are slightly ahead of us. And interestingly, they all seem to be going for the smaller models. Essex, I think, has gone for 5, reduced from 10 down to 5. And one of the other ones that was expected to perhaps be in all county has gone for 3.
North and South have both gone for 3.
So whether that bodes anything for Staffordshire, who knows? But our consultation's still open until midnight tomorrow night. So if you want to offer any views, there is still an opportunity to do that online.
Sussex has gone for a reconsultation.
Yes, and there was one that was.
Which is.
Yeah.
They also had loads of different options that were proposed, which is similar to us.
I think there's one as well that they've gone for something completely different to one that I'm sure that there's one that they've done something completely different to what's been put forward. I can't remember which that one is.
What the government did?
I think so. Yeah, I haven't seen it for myself, but a colleague did mention that. So it's definitely one to watch in the coming days.
Watch this space, then, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
I wish our officers good luck.
So, and members as well, because it will at some point it will impact members as they set the new council up next year, the shadow authority. There will be some joint working across different committees for some of the decisions that need to be made.
Well, and there'll be things that we've not seen before, like if you actually looked at the paperwork that's come out quite recently from the county authority of where they spend their money. Adult and child care, 2/3 of their budget. Mm-hmm. And their budget's 1.4 billion.
That's a hell of a lot of money.
Which so dwarfs anything that we currently do.
It is a mind-blowing number. So there's a lot of work to be done. That's not within our remit at the moment. But thank you very much for going through the stuff that is within our remit and keeping us up to date. Any other comments, ladies and gentlemen?
I just asked if now the demolition's finished, did that come in on budget? I mean, did we spend the same amount of money as we put aside?
I wouldn't like to comment with any authority on that. I know that when it went out to tender, I think it came in slightly cheaper than we were expecting it to. But inevitably, with these types of projects, there's always pieces of work that come up that you're not expecting either. So I know they have had a few things that they weren't necessarily expecting. But I don't know that they've done all of the final cutting on the bills for that yet.
Yeah.
I don't think they're entirely off site either. There's still a little bit of work left to be done. Yeah. There's a couple of things that's still to be done.
See, the project management's running to schedule there. Thank you very much.